Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Morelia Python Radio, brought to you by Morelia Python Forums, www.moreliapythons.com. Tonight, we're talking breeding. We're going pretty much through the entire process, and it's more geared towards the beginners. Hopefully it will be a good reference tool for people to look back and listen to the two of us ramble about the breeding season. So, what's going on, Owen?
What's going on is I hope everybody has their pens and pencils ready and be ready to scribble out things as Eric and I contradict each other. And, hopefully in our incessant ramblings, you will find some way to breed your carpet pythons. If not, we apologize.
I'll just put the disclaimer at the beginning of the show. This is by all means not the end-all, be-all way to breed carpet pythons.
Right.
This is just what we do. And probably,
right,
as you'll see from me and Owen talking, we may do things a little bit different, and we both still have success. So
even though we live like 10 minutes away from each other, we do things drastically different. So it's okay. Find what works for you.
So, before we break into it, I got a couple things that I want to hit on. First, I get a call yesterday from Mr. Zach Baez, and he asked me to take a trip with you over to Rogue Reptiles Site A.
I'm still A.
And I told him, sure. Any chance to see Owen is always a good good time. So, he's so dreamy and all, so.
Stop it, you. People are listening.
I'm going to go over and check it out. So, yeah, we took the trip. We headed over. Zach was claiming his prize, caramel female, which was actually pretty nice. And I think you sparked his interest in coastals again. So
we don't got to talk about the rest. We don't got to talk about anything else that happened.
Don't talk about the tire.
Yeah, don't talk about it. Shut up.
Of course,
what happens normally is when a friend comes over who's also a snake guy, you start like opening drawers and pulling stuff out. And of course, I yelled and screamed and pointed at my IJs because I just had the two big dark side mouths in my snake room, and I said, make these two bastards breed. And they immediately told me it was too hot and to shift the IJs over to a different cage, which was actually close to the temperature that they said would be good. And now we're waiting. Eric was like, I guarantee they'll lock up, but nothing happened. So,
well, in my defense, you don't know if they locked or they didn't.
Oh, damn it, you're right.
I will also say that I followed my own advice, and my IJs were locked up this morning at 5 a.m.
That's your IJ. See, like, even then, you said yesterday, it's like, clearly this guy does not know what he's doing. These IJs are screaming, take us out of here. He's not a dark rider. He doesn't know what's going on. Yeah.
Yeah. They were, like, seeing the second coming of Jesus when they saw me and Zach walk into the room.
Stop it.
Take us out of this place, please.
You would know what to do with IJs the size of mine.
Yeah.
They're monsters compared to yours.
Very, very beautiful. Very, very beautiful. Very nice.
Thank you.
You were checking out
the Mac.
Yeah. You know, yeah. I told this story before. The reason that I picked that up in 2009, that mail.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I picked it up was I went to a pet shop, and they had a Macklots python sitting in the cage, and it was pretty much an adult, and it just blew me away the way it looked. And I said, man, I have to get one of them. And I called Nick Mutton, and of course he had a mail, and I picked it up, and I thought it was really cool. Keep it pretty much the same as carpets. Then we had the incubator malfunction of 2000.
Yeah, that whole thing happened, yeah.
And I lost them, but I'm pretty excited that you have the pair together, because that means I get first pick.
Whoa, wait, really? Oh, well, okay, yeah, sure it does. If your Helma Harris ever breed, though, I get first pick.
Yeah, that's right. So that's the deal.
Damn it, yes. I'm so winning out on that one. So.
Yeah, I know. So,
you're like, ha-ha, I have a $20 Macklot. I'm like, ha-ha. So, yeah.
It's a funny story, as I was telling you before the show started. So me and Zach are driving back, and we hear this thump in the tire, well, up in the front of his car, actually. And I thought it was a twig or something that was caught, you know, like kind of like when you put a card on a bicycle rim and it's that, you know?
Yeah.
So we're driving, and we're like, I don't know, man. So we pull over, and sure enough, we get out of the car, and his tire's just falling apart as we speak. I mean, it's just like melting away. I'm like, son of a bitch. So I was like, all right, let's change this tire. So we're outside of Dunkin' Donuts, and this will tell you what customer service means to us snake people. But anyway, we're standing over there. It's freezing cold. We're taking the tire off. Next thing you know, this guy comes out. He must have been the owner. He worked there or whatever. And he's like, hey, flat tire? He laughed at us. So Zach says, if I was a foot taller, man, this shit be going crazy in here. So I was I can't really help you either, because I'm pretty much your size. So, but I couldn't understand what the dude was laughing at. I was like, son of a bitch, get us a coffee, keep us warm, do something, you know?
Yeah,
like,
do something. Like, here's the thing. And I told you before we came on, I'm like, man, if that guy had walked up to you and been like, flat tire, that sucks. Here, have some, like, have two small coffees or something on me, you know, on the house kind of deal. Like, yeah, sorry to hear that. You would have. Like, if I were you, that would have made me a Dunkin' Donuts guy for the rest of my friggin' life. Would have been like, done,
heck yeah.
Done.
So,
every time I see Dunkin' Donuts, I'd be like, I have a choice between Dunkin' Donuts or McDonald's. Fuck you, I'm going to make Dunkin' Donuts, because when I had a flat tire and was really pissed off at the world, he came out and gave me a coffee. So,
heck yeah.
That is how you earn, like, patronage throughout your life, is being able to do things like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I guess before we get into this whole thing, I got a couple things that I want to hit on. First, I want to give a big shout-out to our friends over at Corrales Radio, Jeff Godbold and Dayton Croydon. We were hanging out with those guys on Sunday, and it was a good time. It's a good show. If you haven't listened to it, or if you've never heard of Corrales Radio, you can go over and check it out. It's their website is CorralesRadio@Weebly.com. You can see all the episodes that they had so far. Those guys are doing a cool job. And Corrales, I think, is very similar to Morelia. And we talked some Morelia. We talked about radio show. We talked some tree boas. It's good stuff. So
some brief history on us. Yada, yada, yada. Yeah. fun stuff.
Let's see, what else do I got? And if speaking of radio shows, if you haven't already heard, we've been nominated by a Reptile Report for the radio show of the year. So if you want us to win that spot, which would be awesome, go over to, I think you can find the links at Morelia Pick of the Week. I think it's pinned at the top, Morelia Python Radio Facebook group page. It's pinned there. And go over, and I think, how does it work, Owen? You can vote every day?
You can vote every day. You just go on, you click on the category that you want to click on, that you want to vote for. There are multiple categories. Click on that, and then click on the person you want to vote. You can vote each day. So make sure you set a clock, set a reminder, do it while you're doing something during the day. Just constantly keep coming in with that votes, because we definitely want to win this one. And if I can say, if you can go over and also please vote for Jamie Kearns at Razor Sharp Reptiles for Gecko Breeder of the Year, M&T Exotics for Tarantula and Invertebrate Breeder of the Year, my good friend Andrew Llewellyn for Lizard Breeder of the Year. That would be also very cool. Just start clicking away, find some good stuff. Those are all those people I just named, very good friends of mine, very good people. I see them at shows around the area all the time. So definitely vote us, vote them, vote everybody you want, but every day.
Right. Okay. So, yep, there you go. Let's get some action over there. let's see. I have a couple more things. There was an interesting video, and the video is over. Yeah, it was over on Morelia Python Radio Facebook group, but it was posted up or shared by Graham Battinson, and it's Reptile TV. I think it's somebody from Germany. It must be kind of like Snake Bites TV, but the German version of it. But the cool thing was is that he went and saw Bill Brandt, and he is he's one of the biggest reptile breeders in the United States, if not the world, gourmetrodent.com. Anyway, he's gone through his facility, and he's looking at the colubrids, and he has some cool stuff there. And then he goes to the ball pythons, which, by the way, there was a fire pinstripe enchi. I'm not a big ball python guy, but goddamn, that thing is freaking sweet, man. You got to check it out. But anyway.
Was that even English you just said? The fire pinstripe enchi? Like,
yeah,
or should I just say
cool,
bless
man.
You? Bless
yeah,
you.
It was.
I mean,
it was cool.
Okay.
Cool thing about what he does with ball pythons is that, and I've heard this before, but he breeds them all year round, right?
Jesus.
And he uses an ultrasound, and he doesn't cycle at all. So basically he
that
checks
them. That is so cool.
Yeah, he checks their follicle growth once a month, and he sees where they're at. And then when they get to a certain size, I can't remember what the size he said, but as soon as they get to that size, he just puts the male in, and boom. The cool thing with his colubrids too, I think he had like six colonies, and what he does is he makes it so that each colony breeds like one would come out of hibernation in July. You know what I mean? So it wouldn't be like all the babies at one time. It would be like July you would have babies. Yeah, exactly. So I thought that was pretty cool. Anyway, he the same. Way that he breeds the ball pythons, he did this for the Timor pythons. And I don't know if you know much about them. I really don't know much about them other than they're pretty difficult to breed. And not a lot of people have done it. But he doesn't cycle them. I think he said he had like 4.5 group. And last year he got three clutches out of them.
Jesus!
So he got three captive born and bred Timor pythons. Which is a pretty big accomplishment.
Wow.
You know, if you got one, I can say
Ben would love that.
Lucky.
I know he's trying.
Yeah, and he didn't cycle them at all. Did the same thing as what he did. He gave kind of what I do, where he's like has an ambient temperature of 80, and then maybe a hot spot of like 84 or something. Very little gradient, but no cycle at all.
Right.
But the cool thing was is that he has Bolin's pythons, but he's keeping them in racks. And he's doing the same thing. So, you know, I've talked to people before. I don't know if you've ever heard, but Pro Exotics, they used to breed heel monsters, and they had such a difficult time breeding them, and they used to keep them in the same type of they had, like, these big, huge troughs that they would keep, like, their monitors and stuff in.
Yeah.
And they weren't successful with them, and I forget what happened, but for some reason they decided to put them in racks, and boom, they just bred away. It was, like, easy as could be. So I guess the thinking is that, you know, is it more secure for them? I guess with heel monsters, they're underground most of the time, similar to, like, what ball pythons are like. Maybe that's why they do really good racks. But I think my thinking with bones pythons, if I were to have a cage set up, I would definitely do, like, a cage, and then underneath would be, like, some kind of drawer system. I don't know if you remember Bob Applegate with the king snakes, how he used to do that. And I think Justin Julander does that same type of idea.
I think so. That's where they can go underneath and things like that, right?
Yeah. But he's pretty much following the same thing, those thermal gradient with the well, I don't know that for a fact. But the cool thing is that he kind of mixes it up, but I think he's trying to give a shout-out to Morelia Python Radio, like he listens, because he's saying that he heard the interview that we did with Terry Phillip, and he kind of got the thinking with that. So I thought that was pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
This guy's listening to us. So, hey, Bill Brand, if you're out there and you're listening, you know, that was a cool video, cool stuff. If I'm ever down there
in
Florida, I definitely would love to check them out. So it's cool stuff. Let's see what else. I have to give a shout-out to Dave Perlich. I don't know if you saw him, but I guess he wins the he's from I guess I'm saying this right, Morelia R Evolution. He got the first clutch, Coastals, on the ground.
Yeah.
Did you see that already?
Yes, I did. It freaked the hell out of me. Don't know what to do with it.
Right.
Confusing as all shit. Everything I knew, out the window, everything we're about to talk about makes no goddamn sense.
No,
I mean,
not at all.
Yep.
So.
Totally don't know. I mean, it's really cool, and I really wish that it's something cooking in there that it's like, maybe there is a way to breed them out of season, and maybe this way they can constantly just, you know, I don't have to wait a whole year to get an animal that I want. But it's just really weird, and it's kind of like, is it a fluke? Is this going to happen again? Can he repeat it?
I don't know, man. I watched his post. You know, it's on Facebook, and I watched the people's posts and all, and I was watching him, and he said for sure that he was going to be getting eggs any day now, and I was kind of like, oh, I don't know, man. That's kind of early, and boom, sure enough.
I've had people message me where it's like, I got this girl from female from a reptile show. She looks massive. Could she be gravid? And I'm like, it is August. No. No, it cannot be. Or, like, it's September or October. It's like, no. No, you stupid. No, of course not.
Right.
And now it's like, he's just dropping eggs. I'm like, shit.
Hey, man.
Maybe.
Possible. I also wanted to, speaking of Coastals, it seems to me, I don't know if you've been paying attention, but it seems like Coastals are getting some love as of late. It seems like I see a lot more people posting Coastals. And you want to talk about some knockout Coastals, I got to give a shout-out to Eric Hernandez. He has some fabulous, fabulous Coastals. I know he posted up over Morelia Pick of the Week, so go over there, check it out, and check out what he has going on, because what he's doing, man, is beautiful. And it's pretty cool that when you see guys and they're focusing on a specific thing and the results they get, which we'll get into as we start to delve in breeding stuff. So I think that's kind of everything I have. Did you have anything you wanted to hit on?
I got nothing that I want to hit on this time. Check back later.
Okay.
All right. There we are then.
There we go. All right. So the breeding season. I kind of think of the season, I don't know about you, Owen, but I kind of think of the season as a whole year-round type of thing. When I first got into breeding snakes, it seemed to me like it was only the small chunk of time. But once you start doing it, it seems like as soon as your babies are getting established, you're back into breeding mode again.
You're never done. And if you think you are done, it's because you're not focused. Yeah, if you're either working at a project, you're either working on here's the thing. You're either the breeding season technically begins in October when I start, you know, slowing down food and, you know, all that other stuff, and then it kicks into November when I start, you know, tickling down, like, you know, trickling down temps, and now we're in December and it's in full blown. Everybody's down where they should be and is in full cool till January, so I start bringing up in February. Now, you think, by definition, breeding season is over in February, you know, through May when you get eggs. No, because then once you get the eggs, you have to, you know, incubate the eggs either way you want to incubate them. Either mom does it or it's in the incubator. Then you have hatchings in June, and then not only are you trying to get babies to eat and, you know, grow and feed and get ready to get out of here in the summertime, you're also trying to get your breeding stock back up to size, back into shape, and ready for next year. So if you're not paying attention, something slips up. Your babies all don't feed or get, you know, stupid, and you don't have a female that you wanted to breed this year ready to go, ready to size. I'll admit it myself. I've had a few females that I wanted to go this year that I had to hold back because I didn't get them up to the size that I wanted to before breeding because I was so distracted with everything else going on this summer.
Right.
So I kind of shot myself in the foot by not doing that.
Right. Well, it's you know, at least that you're able to realize that, because we'll get into that, what could happen if they're not ready for breeding. But I guess the starting spot would be getting your stock.
Yes.
I think that, I'll just give my opinion and you can give your opinion, but I think that this is where, you know, you hear a lot of people talk about it. Most people that have podcasts or if you're at a show or anything, the big thing is to say, buy captive bred, buy captive bred, buy captive bred. This is where to me, if you're focused on breeding and you have, like some Morelia, you can't really, you know, deal with scrubs and stuff. You're dealing with wild caught stuff. But then I would go for the smaller you can get it, the better you're going to be. So
yes.
But
yes.
I would always say captive, born and bred first. There's so many breeders out there. There's so many people that are working with something that you could find it somewhere and, you know, get what you're looking for, so to speak.
Right. Right.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, like farm-raised and wild-caughts are, and it should be your last option. I mean, there are so many animals here in the United States being born and bred here that there really is, in some cases, no reason to. And if you find yourself going that route, it's because you're greedy, because you want the cheapest animal. You don't want to spend that much money. Where you got to think about it this way. It's your project. You're going to get whatever it is you pay into it. So,
right.
And I totally agree. Even buying babies and raising them up is a whole lot better than buying adults and attempting to breed. I've never had an issue with any carpet python I've raised from a hatchling. They are, from a young age, know how the cycle works, how I do everything here. They grow up with it. They're prone to it. They're ready for it. So, but they've been some of my best breeders.
Right. Absolutely.
Every year. So.
I would say that the next point that I would hit on as far as getting your stock is, you know, don't run out and just grab something just because you have the itch. We all know what that itch is. You know, we all.
It's terrible.
You see something, you see a post, you're like, you know, oh, my God, I want that. You know, I want to work with that, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, you have to try to fight that itch. And I think, you know, focus on what you want to do. you know, really think about what you want to do and what you're trying to accomplish. I guess in a nutshell, what I'm trying to say is just because you have a male and a female snake, don't just think that that should go together, you know.
Right.
There should be some thought behind what you're doing.
Yeah, you can't just jump into it because if I were to breed just every single carpet python I had, let's put it this way, I have my male Hycon Pyro. If I bred him with my big female Sophie just to get baby snakes, I'll get a bunch of really normal-looking drab baby coastals with no bloodline, no purpose, no nothing. It's like they'd be here and they'd be good pets and everything, but I wouldn't do that because there'd be no point and purpose behind the breeding, and they'd just be babies to bring into this world for needless points. So,
right.
No.
Absolutely. You know, like I said, I think you should really think about what your focus, what you like. What do you like? You know, if you like whatever, then, you know, you should work with it. If you like coastals, mm-hmm. then breed coastals, you know. Don't think that you have to work with jungles just because, you know, that's what you think everybody likes. Do what you like, you know. And that's the most important because patience is key with breeding. Just like you just said a couple minutes ago, Owen, you know, if you're not focused and you're not getting things going, you may miss, the girl may not go, the male may not go, you might, you know, for whatever reason, you might have to wait another year. You thought they would be of size, or maybe two males become, you know, or two, a pair becomes two males.
Pair becomes two males, yeah.
Two females,
really,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's important to grow. Yeah, yeah. I'm sure they will happen to all carpet breeders at some
I've
point.
Gotten to the point now where if it's of a certain size and I think it's a boy, I'm throwing it in with my proven male, and if they combat, good, it's a boy. I mean, it's kind of that point now where that's how I'm going to sex animals, is that if it's old enough, let's see if it's a boy. Throw it in with a boy. If they start fighting, it's clearly a boy. So.
Right. Yeah, I don't know if there's ever been – and to me that would be a no-brainer way to check it. So
bring one of my boys with me everywhere.
Yeah, maybe you can comment on this, Owen. And again, I'm not really speaking. I'm speaking from my experience. But what I found is that if you want to be successful, you know, maybe you want to focus until you are a more established breeder or somebody that, you know, you've had more experience with working with different groups. Maybe you want to just focus on working with a particular species or subspecies. And what I mean by that is that, you know, if you're breeding pythons, you probably don't want to breed colubrids at the same time. You know what I'm saying? You probably want to pick one or the other and focus on it. When you feel that you kind of know what you're doing, then try to go out and get something else.
Yes. I mean, I agree, only because I did it improperly. I did it the wrong way. I was breeding carpet pythons and corn snakes and cow kings and bull snakes and all that stuff all at once. It's a lot of babies. It's a lot of different needs when it comes to temperature-wise. It's a lot of different needs when it comes to breeding-wise. And it's also, in my case, the cow kings, they'll kill each other if you're not paying attention. So there's a lot of things you got to keep in mind. And it also can hinder your snake room because, you know, the cow kings and all the other corn snakes and all those things, it was easy for me because I would just pull them out of the room, and that's how they would winter. But imagine if you can't pull them out of the room, then now you got to try to winter them while not kill everything else in the room. So if you're confined with space, it would be really a whole lot easier if you just stuck with one subspecies and one thing and get that under control. And then you can move on. Like, for the longest time, everybody knew I just did coastals. Because it was Jason Balin's in my backyard at every single one of the reptiles I went to. And he primarily did coastals. And I was just feeding off of that stuff. And, you know, I originally wanted jungles. Chris had carpet pythons, and I always told him I wanted a jungle. And then I got a coastal. And that's what started me on the coastals, because I had a coastal and I had to work the project around the coastal that I had. So never even occurred to me to branch off until the INHA fell into my lap and I branched off into jungle with the zebras. So, you know, you work with one and then you can worry about the whole room goes down at a certain temp. Everybody does this one thing. You don't have to worry about mixing and matching your pairings or pissing somebody off because you might be making a mutt just because that's what you have, because all you have is pure coastal. You can throw that guy with this girl and you're good. Too many times have I heard people going, like, they want to buy something. A lot of times people told me that they want to buy one of my Tigers or my Jaguars to pair up with their IJ Jungle. I'm like, well, why do you want to pair it with your IJ Jungle? Well, that's all I have right now. It's breeding for the sake of breeding. And I always tell them, you know, you're not going to be able – this is always the argument that gets them, because I always say, well, what are you trying to get out of this pairing? And they go, oh, just some baby carpets, some really nice Jags. I'm like, well, you know, not a lot of people are going to want those Jaguars. Really?
Right.
Yes, they're not. You're not going to be able to make that many sales. Not that many people are going to want it because it's not pure. There's no lineage, and there's not even a purpose behind the Jags other than it's just a Jag.
Right.
So you won't be able to ask, like, you're buying this Jag for me for $300. You're not going to be able to ask that price when you get your own baby Jags with that pairing.
Right.
And so sometimes they go sideways and they buy, you know, something else, or they try to pair up the Jag that they wanted to buy for me with something else that I have, or so a lot of times they just bag it. So.
Right. I think the, you know, when you're talking about picking out pairs with and what is the purpose, I think to me why coastals haven't gotten the selective breeding that, say, jungles have is because most people were just pairing it up, whatever coastal they had, with a Jag, you know, back in the day. And I think that a lot of times with – this might not be so true of carpet python people, but I think this might be where, you know, like maybe the ball python guys don't really focus on that as much. And it's not all of them, because there are some people that do really focus on what they're breeding to what. And I think sometimes when you're dealing with morphs, you're just trying to punch out, like, you know, if you're breeding a caramel zebra, you're just going to put it to whatever, you know. I'm just going to put this with the jungle and, you know, hopefully it breeds. And if it's the ugliest jungle that you have is the female that you have up the size, some people will put it with that and then be like, you know, why am I getting ugly caramel zebras? You know, well, probably because, you know.
Yeah, you get in what you take out, and that's more like, you're exactly correct. The reason coastal has gotten so far behind is because there wasn't that much line breeding done before Jag. And once Jag came out, it decimated the whole thing, because everybody was taking whatever coastal they had and throwing it to a Jag.
Right.
And you honest to God get what you threw in with a Jag. If you threw an ugly animal with a subpar Jag, you're going to get subpar baby Jags and ugly, ugly siblings. My first breeding was my MBB female Aurora to my Hycon Pyro. And I loved those babies when they came out. They were bright freaking yellow, and they were gorgeous. In the siblings, I had a couple siblings that I regret letting go. So it's what you put in. And if there's something you like about a female or a male, if there's something like you like about your snake, and you want to try to enhance that, be picky, take your time, find the right one. I have that ivory diamond jungle Jag female, that white one that I have.
Right.
And I want to get an ivory boy, but I'm so goddamn picky that no ivory boy so far has been what I want. So, unless, of course, that you were going to sell yours.
No.
I'll take that as a no. All right, well.
That would be a no.
That would be a no. Anyway, but that is what it is. I'm really picky because I want to make sure that the white comes through. Otherwise, the whole project's downhill. Why would I grab a bright yellow jungle and breed it to her? So it just wouldn't make sense.
Absolutely, yeah. It's just, you know, you have to think about what you're pairing. So if you're breeding for a stripes, you want to make sure that, you know, you're not going to breed an animal that's totally banded. Although, I guess with tigers, that's not always necessarily true. But I'm just talking,
no.
If you're not talking about a morph or anything like that, you know, you want to breed stripe to stripe, and you're going to refine the stripe a little bit better. But, that kind of, it's important.
Yeah, it's like exactly what you said. If you're looking to make stripes, don't shoot yourself in the foot and breed it with a banded animal. Make it really freaking easy and find another striped animal, because then all the babies are going to be what? Holy crap, striped. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Me personally, I'd probably go a little overboard, but I've thought about my pairings. And what I do is I kind of, when I'm acquiring stock, another tip is you get females before you get your males.
Yes.
Because males don't take as long to grow up. Females, you know, take a little longer to grow up. I guess, what are we talking? Let's see if we can give people an idea. I don't really focus on size so much as far as breeding as I do with age. I don't know how to explain this, but Jason Balin told this to me one time, and I didn't really get what he was talking about until I saw it with my own eyes. But there's something about a carpet python's head that changes when they become mature. Would you agree with that?
Right. I would totally agree. They get the muscles behind their head, and they get a big, defined python head. And it just can kind of happen overnight where all of a sudden they just seem broader and more arrow-headed instead of that little baby that you saw earlier. So.
Yeah, so I would say, what's the thinking? You could probably breed a female as early as, what, 2.5 years? I guess the regular age would be 3 years. Is that the average?
My normal thing is 3 years. And normally for them to be of size at 3 years, you're looking at a 4 or 5 foot animal for me.
Okay. So what would you be breeding this year for the first time? What are you talking? You're talking 2010 should be going for you this year?
I am not. My 2010 did not make the cut. My one female, she doesn't look mature enough for me. She's not big enough, in my opinion. I am breeding one 2010, and she, I think, is big enough, but I'm kind of on the fence about it. We'll see. Okay. Those are the two females that I'm breeding are my two 2010s. My one 2010. My other, I have three 2010s. One made the cut, two didn't. So.
Okay. But your 2009s are pretty much, you know, at this point, they're the solid animals, so what you could breed.
They're about ready to go. My 2008s, 2007s have all been breeding, you know.
Right.
I have, and then, of course, the 2011 boys are ready to go.
Right. Yeah, boys, like I said, don't need as long. The zebra jag that you have, he bred at, I think he was 650 grams. So,
yeah.
I mean, they can breed small. No doubt.
Yeah, I bred my tiger boy at a year old. So,
yeah,
it's all relative. If you put him in with a female that's kind of smaller, you can get the job done. If you try to put him in with your, you know, 8 foot monster, you're what? That's not going to happen. I know a couple 5 footers that wouldn't take on a 7 footer. So yeah, it's okay.
Yeah.
Be smart about it.
Right. Okay. So, what, you know, as far as a male, if it's not mature or of size, no harm done. You put them together, nothing happens, you pull them out. But what would
he
be
runs.
Some of the things you would happen if you breed a female too young?
Egg binding is the big one. If a female's not of mature age, she'll bind up. If she can't possibly pass the eggs, and that could lead to surgery or death. That is a definitely big one. Prolapse of the uterus when she goes to expel the eggs. Sometimes they'll shoot out most of it. Normally, if there is a prolapse, it is due to egg retention, which, again, can be either surgery or having a good friend come over and remove the eggs while you panic in the corner. other thing is that, you know, some females, I've noticed this, is that some animals will get so stressed out that another animal's in their cage that they're not ready, that they'll force themselves into a corner of the cage and not move, which they're not going to thermoregulate, which means they could get sick. So that's something else you got to worry about, something else to concern yourself with.
Right.
So girls that are designing is a bad deal. It's, in my opinion, it is always better to hold a female back a year than to risk it and kill her. Like, I just told you, I have two 2010s that I did not pair because I'm not 100% on them, so they're going to wait. I don't care. They'll be here next year.
Right. Yeah. Yep. There's no there's no race when it comes to this for me. I mean, you know, I might try this if I sit on the fence and see what happens, but, you know, for the most part, I'm a slow grower and taking my time, so... So there you go.
Yep.
I would say that IJs and jungles, they would probably fall into a smaller, you know, smaller size. Coastals typically breed on the larger side. I would say, especially if you're working with southern coastals, which not many people are, but that would be my thought there. Inlands, I know Brettles, they're on the larger side. Just so everybody knows, I'm sure that most people know this, but if you're new to carpet python breeding, basically how it breaks down is you have two groups of breeders. You have winter breeders and then you have spring breeders. The winter breeders are your IJs, your jungles, your Darwins, your coastals. Your spring breeders are your Brettles, your Inlands, your Southwesterns, and the Diamonds.
Right.
I said, yeah. And basically what I mean by that is that the other ones will breed during the winter. The spring breeders will breed once it warms back up. So,
right.
If you're working with any of those spring breeders, you want to wait until you warm it back up before you start the breeding process.
That is not being said that you cannot introduce after winter and get success, because my first season, I did it completely backwards. I did not introduce until after I had warmed everybody up. And then I put them together, got locks. I didn't get babies till... Like, I didn't get eggs till June, July, and then, of course, I didn't get eggs and I didn't get babies hatching until, like, August, September. So
Right. It's
late, and you don't ever want to do it that way, because then you end up having babies trying to eat as the weather outside is changing, and you end up going absolutely insane. But it can be done various ways. So don't ever count the season over until the season's over. Like, you can... Keep pairing, keep trying, who knows?
Right. Let's see. The next thing that I would is when do you start to think about your breeding season for the year? So typically the way python breeding works, it's that you've kind of follow the outside temperatures and you kind of, you know, it's easier to cool rooms down and all this kind of stuff. If you're doing a cool down when the weather outside is cooler, you know, obviously if the weather outside is 90 degrees, it's going to be a little bit more difficult to get your ambient temperatures down to where they need to be. So that being said, typically how it works is that you would start to cool down in November, December. Some people do it in October. I guess it really just depends on what's going on outside. The outside weather. That's what I would recommend following. That's what's given me success.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I start to look at what I'm going to try to pair, say, July. I try to get a feel for, what I'd like to do that season and see where the females are at. And if they seem like they might be a go, I'm going to start to feed them in July. And I will do every 2 weeks for an adult. Some people will feed more, Some people feed less, but that's typically what I do. I've noticed that I don't feed enough. I kind of fell into that category where you kind of like not paying attention to what you're feeding. But I noticed that it seems that my females are not where I want them to be. And I think they have to get a little bit bigger. And I think where I made the mistake is that as they're growing up, maybe their first year, you should be feeding them probably once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. But you should feed them consistently. Whereas with adults, I think you could like during the breeding season, I don't feed at all. Some people
do.
I do not.
I thaw out for food for the babies and things like that, and I see the adults squirming and moving like they normally do when they see food, but half of them, if offered, would not take just because they're unhappy. There's another snake in their cage. They're a little cooler. They don't feel it, or they just want out. I don't even bother. It's thawing rats out for no reason. Plus, it also does give your food bill a little bit of a break, which, of course, you know, helps you financially, especially on my end. You know, I blow through a bag of jumbo rats when I feed all my adults, and that's a pretty penny. So
right. So
it helps to not do that for a couple months a year.
Right. I would start, like I said, feeding up in July and offering more food, maybe bigger food items. I might go a little bit bigger, to try to get them to think. My thinking there is that if, and I could be totally off base with this, but if food is abundant, then I'm going to breed, you know.
Right.
That's how simplistically I would look at it. So I don't know if the snakes really care about that. You know, there's some people that cycle the food as they go through the season. I kind of thought it was a good idea, so that's kind of what I do. You're feeding pretty consistently. Is that what you're doing, Owen?
My thing is that I feed usually once a week when they're babies, and then I kind of sputter it off to once every other week when they're probably about a year, year and a half old. And then if they're boys, it's usually like every two. And then as they get to be adult boys, like my proven breeding males hate me because I don't feed them. And like, it's like, oh, I have an extra rat, which boy's hungry. So one of those things. So
right.
I agree with what you said. It's about picking your pears out in the summertime around June, July is when I pick out my pears because it also helps to – that is also when I'm in the mood to try to either replace, replenish, or, you know, build a project. Because if I can get the animals in June, they've got July, August, September to get all ready and happy in their little cage and set in their new territory before they go down in October.
Right.
So it's like if I were to get a male carpet, just like the zebra jag I got from you,
right.
I wish I had gotten him in June because I would have had him all summer to settle. So,
right.
And but I think he settled fine. But it's just one of those things that you can do.
Right. With the breeding, you know, going into breeding season, I usually just real quick. I think if you look in the Complete Carpet Python book, Ben does a chapter on reproduction, and what he talks about is body condition, and what he means by that is the mass of the body related to the length of the snake, and that's kind of where he gets body condition. So it's not necessarily the length, how long the snake is. It has to kind of be a mix of both, you know, how long is the snake and what does the snake weigh. Because you're going to have, like, I have an adult IJ, female IJ. When she bred, this is Dor, but when she bred the first time, I couldn't believe how small she is in relation to, like, some of the coastals that, say, you have. You know, I couldn't believe that, you know, that IJ laid 10 eggs, you know, but she did.
Right.
And she's in perfect condition and body condition is good. But if you look at her body condition as related to the length of her, you would probably see that she's probably on par with what your coastals are.
Right.
You know, if you were looking at it, comparing apples to apples. And
if you were to shrink down a coastal, it would look the same. It's just like if you were to blow her up, it would look the same.
Right. You know? And, yeah. You know, I'm going to quote the reproduction of pythons and boas. That's the Blue Bible. If people aren't, sure what I'm talking about, but the book's been around for a while. Basically, in the book, they talk about the studies in humans show that women that are undernourished give birth to an infant whose growth rate will be below normal throughout their life, even if the child is provided with the proper nutrition. Furthermore, the women's children's children will also be affected. So, you know, that's why we were saying earlier about making sure that I think I actually got this from you, Owen, is like the first year that they're growing up, you want to make sure that you're providing them with that nutrition on a weekly, maybe every 10 days feeding type of regimen. So,
yeah, it's really hard. Like, people are like, I don't want my baby snake to be fat. It's really hard, if ever, to get a baby python to be overweight. Because it's just they grow lengthwise so fast, and you can feed them about every week, and they'll grow at that rate. But you got to know when to back it off, or you will get an obese snake, or hinder that snake's life. You know, the babies just grow so quick. You and Zach saw my Holbeck Super Caramel yesterday. Exactly.
Yes.
Like, God, that's like one of my yearlings. I'm like, well, no, she's eating. I mean, she's been eating since she got out of the egg. So, and it's the recovery for them. That they bounce back so quick, and they end up they put on the size, and it happens fast. I mean, like right now, I have yearlings that are on small rats, which is good because they'll be on par for breeding when they're ready.
Right.
So, yeah.
So, okay. So there you go. That's kind of like where you're getting. I'm keeping during this time, my normal temps. My normal temps are basically 80 ambient, 85 hotspot. I don't turn the hotspot off at night, but my ambient might get down to like 78 maybe at night during the summertime.
Okay.
But they still have that 85 degree, you know. So actually it averages out to about 80 degrees, so to speak. That's how I would look at
it. Are you talking about the summertime?
Yeah.
In the summertime, I do the same thing. They have the ambient temp of about 80, 82, and then I give them their hot spots at about 85. So.
All right, so now we're going to go into the cool down. This is kind of weak. You know, I start in November, one of the things that I learned is that once your females are going and you kind of have an established time frame, it seems like they know that it's time without you telling them it's time. They just kind of go into that mode. It becomes like a fine-tuned clock. Everything kind of just goes based on the seasons of what's going on. So that being said, I give a clean out. I give a 2-week clean out where, you know, I just let them kind of empty out from the last feeding that they do and before I start to drop temps. That way there's no troubles. You don't have any issues with the cooler temps and food digesting and anything like that. Although with the temps that I provide through the cool down, technically, you could still feed during the cool down, but I just choose not to. I kind of let them do their thing and settle down and kind of take a break. So, what about you? Same thing?
I pretty much do the same thing. What I do is around October 1st, they start getting fed smaller meals and it starts getting, like, really scarce. And then around, like, mid-October, it stops. And that's what I call that bite season, because they're pissed. Food ain't coming and they know winter's coming. So that's when, like, if I take a hit, that's when it's going to be bad. So everybody does the cool down. And then about November 1st is when the temps start to drop. I usually try to do a degree a day. With the night drop in the with the Herbstat 4s, you can set the night drop for when it clicks on over to nighttime. So you just got to punch up the numbers and set everything up. So that's what I usually do. And then every day for work, I'd run downstairs and type on each one of the little computer systems and lower it down a degree. So then that night it gets a little colder until about now, right? Until about we're here right now where everything gets a little colder. So I am having some trouble making the room cooler this year, so I may have to open the door.
Yeah, I kind of do the same thing. I do a seven weeks total is how it goes. So
yeah,
I'm looking at from the normal temperature regimen that I follow all the way down to when it would be, say, the dead of winter, and then back up to normal temperatures again. I'm looking at a 7 week total span of what I do. So basically, I don't do anything to the temperatures during the day. I give them the same temperatures that I do all the time during the day. I don't lower the temperatures. I know some people do that. I do not. I don't want any respiratory infections or anything like that. And my thought is that if you allow them to thermoregulate during the day, then they'll be fine and you won't have any issues.
Right. I totally agree. And I keep my hot spots the same all year round. I just lower the nighttime drop because you get that little nighttime drop and then eventually they start going. Don't be discouraged if you don't see locks because sometimes they're secretive. So.
Right. Yep. one of the things, actually, this is pretty cool that we're talking about this at this point, but on the video, if you're over on the Morelia Python Radio Facebook page, you can look at that video. I bumped it up to the top. That was the video with the Bill Brandt, and what he said is, and it kind of made sense, is that he used to do a gradual cool down. Now he doesn't do a gradual cool down. He just, here it is, it's wintertime, boom. Drop it down to the base temperature that you're going to hit. But he was talking about colubrids. I don't know. I guess he may approach the same thing with his pythons. I'm not really sure.
Colubrids can kind of take it a lot harsher. Like right now, I'll tell you that I have my corn snakes in a tub under my bed, and it's 30 degrees.
Right.
And I checked on them. I checked on them yesterday, and all three of them were moving around the cage and looking up at me like, is it dinner time? So it's they're a lot easier. Imagine a corn snake is a lot like a brittle where, you drop the temp and it's like, yeah, what else you got? So.
There you go.
So,
I think, I guess you could kind of do it either way, but I do a gradual, maybe at one point I might change it, but mine is a gradual cool down just to kind of let them know before you just hit that, my what I'm shooting for is 70 degrees ambient temperature at night. That's my lowest point that I hit. But I'm not working with breeding brettles, diamonds, or inlands yet. So, that may change. I may have a different approach. So right now I'm just speaking as far as jungles, coastals, Darwins, and IJs, which is pretty much what everybody has at this point, what everybody's kind of working with. So I get down to 70 as my target temperature. I keep it down there for 2 weeks, and then I gradually raise it back up to that 78 temperature at night.
Right.
So during this time, what are you looking for in your female zone? What stands out as, what are some observations? What are the females doing? What's behavior that you're seeing in your females during this cool down time?
At this point, what I'm looking for is if they're getting along with the boy. I mean, if they're coiled up together, you're on the right track, because locks are going to happen whether you see them or not. But if they're on opposite ends of the cage, if she runs every time she touches him, if there's aggression, there's some stuff you gotta worry about. Sometimes the boys just don't like the girls; they just kind of don't like each other.
Right.
So you gotta kind of adjust to that. Sometimes the boy gets freaked out by the girl. So that's what I'm looking for. Now, as far as like catching ob swells or, you know, follicles, I'm terrible at that. I really am. To this day, I've yet to look at one of my girls and go, that's an ovulation swell. And every year I have an argument with Chris that we're not going to have any eggs because I don't think any of the females are pregnant. And then next day I see one of them basking belly up, and I'm like, score. That is my thing. If I see a bask belly up, I know I'm good. Till then, I'm complete doubting myself. So, yeah.
One of the things that I would say is that I have not seen my females bask belly up. So,
it's awesome when they do it.
I would agree with you that it's probably a telltale sign that your females are gravid. But during this time, I guess, jumping ahead, I kind of, during the cool down, I introduce my males with my females, just to kind of let them know that males are around. Some people may not. Some people keep their males and females together year round. You know, and people have success with it. I know the guys at Australian Addiction, that's kind of their way of doing things. They just kind of put the pair together and, you know, let them do their thing. Probably, like you said, you're not going to see lockups as frequent. You may miss it totally and not see it locked at all.
I didn't see a single one last year, and I had three clutches. So,
well, there you go.
Don't be discouraged if you don't see a lock. Sometimes it just happens.
For sake of, for what I'm looking at, I'm looking at to see, you know, is the female going into shed? Is she getting tight? Where is she sitting? I would say that I noticed before ovulation, I usually see females on the cooler side of the cage. I don't see them really looking for heat. I see them just kind of chilling out on the cooler side. usually when I see all my females doing the same thing, that's a good sign. Females, when they're all over on the cooler side of the cage, it's usually a good sign. The other good sign is when you go in and you see your males just cruising the cage, just cruising around. They're constantly moving. To me, that's a good sign to say that they kind of picked up that females are ready, or they know that there's females in the room. Maybe they're picking up on the hormonal cues. I really don't know, but usually when I see that, that usually tells me, okay, it's time to maybe put the male into the cage and see what happens, into the female's cage. I put the male into the females. I don't know if you do the same.
I do the same because I'm thinking boys are going to cruise. Plus, with my setups, sometimes I have to move the females around. I have some in racks. I don't want them in cages, or there's an empty cage, and I'll throw a girl in there. Sometimes it's good if I throw a girl that I'm not to throw a girl into a boy's cage and then throw a different boy into that cage. Like right now, my Macklots that are normally living in a rack are now in a cage for breeding. And I threw my male Mac in there, and he went crazy because it smelled like different. He didn't know where the hell he was. He could smell this other larger snake. And then all of a sudden there was a female Macklot, so I'm pretty sure he's totally freaked out now. So,
right. So at this point, I'm looking, like I said, putting the females and males together, even if it's just temporarily putting them and housing them together. I will separate them out. As soon as the As soon as I'm back up to normal temperatures, the only time I separate them is when I start to feed the females again. But we'll get into that as we get along. Light cycles. You do anything with light cycles?
I have a 12 or 12. I have a 12-12 light cycle on year round.
Okay. I do a 12-12 normally, and then I switch to an 8-16. 8 hours day, 16 hours, no light.
I probably would, but I don't remember how to set my timer on my snake room anymore. So,
all right, fair enough.
The light cycles are 12 for 12, and they will remain 12 for 12 until I figure that out again. So,
I don't know if it matters or it doesn't matter. I know one of the guys that I looked up to, Luke Snell, I know he did it. So I kind of just adopted it into my plan. I just follow whatever the lights are going on outside, sunrise, sunset. That's kind of what I follow. So maybe it matters, maybe it doesn't matter. I don't know. I think that it makes sense to think that everything is kind of revolves around the sun. So it only makes sense to me to think that animals are cued into that. So. I just have a window in my room. I leave that open, and I let it go on. And then there is a light in the room that's clicked to a timer that kind of just follows that. But
and
I would say
I
this.
Do not
once,
have,
well, go ahead. You don't have a
I
window.
I said I don't have light. Yeah, I'm in the basement, so.
Right. So, no. It can be done either way.
Yes.
You know, because obviously Owen has success and I have success, so either way it can be done. So there you go with that. We talked about we kind of hit on when we start raising the temps up, when we're putting them back up into the swing of things.
Right. That would be I start ramping up in February. February 1st is when I start bringing everybody up.
Okay. 7 weeks from when I start is when I'm back up in that mode. So now we're back up. We went through the cool down. Some people don't cool down at all. They keep that ambient temp. I think if you're going to follow that method, you have to be really cued in on what's going on with your females. And obviously you have to be able to feel your snakes. For the follicle growth, you have to be able to understand what's going on. And I think if you did that and you have an ultrasound, that's pretty much spot on.
I think that'd be pretty good.
Yeah. If you have that tool at your disposal, you probably don't have to worry about, cool down or not cool down. Because obviously if she ovulates, that's pretty much... what you need. So,
you've done well,
Yeah, it's really just trying to get those females to cue in that it is time to breed and to ovulate. Because let's face it, they want to breed. I mean, it's in their nature to want to breed. It's kind of human nature, or not human, it's kind of nature just in general that everything wants to reproduce. So we just have to let them know that it's time. I think sometimes the people are so cued in on what they think is because somebody you read it in a book or you're listening to what somebody said that that they're kind of not paying attention to what's going on with their snakes and then they miss it and then they're trying to figure out why won't my snakes breed, why won't they breed, you know. I think like the clutch we talked about earlier. David he's cued in. Dave, he's watching his females. He knew it, and now he has eggs. So, you know, if he would listen to what we're saying right now, he may have missed it.
Yeah.
You know, so watch your females. That's the most important.
Always.
So we're back. Yeah, we're back up. Looking at the. You know, you can't get. I guess the next thing that we would talk about is male combat. Are you doing that during the cool down? Have you done it? Are you doing it when it's warmed up? What's your thought?
I've done it by accident so far this year by putting in a trio and then realizing that one of them's that was a girl turned out to be a boy. So
okay.
I've done it accidentally this year, twice now. So
okay.
the cause of that is very good for the winter, and it does, I think, help with the breeding. But the next thing would be to you can do it in the warm-up. I would especially do it if there was maybe a pair that you didn't see any action out of at all. You might want to be like, all right, well, here you go. Come here. And chuck another male in there. I also have that trick of I have this spray bottle filled with a rival male's shed. And
right.
Right now I'm looking at my caramel jag is going to shed soon, and so is my red tiger male. And the second they do it, I'm taking their sheds and I'm ripping them up and throwing them into cages. Because that's worked for me in the past, whereas you just get the scent of another male around.
Okay.
Sometimes your boys kind of just go off the deep end.
Right.
And they want to breed with whatever's in front of them. So been helpful. I don't really like doing combat, like leaving them in there. It should never be one of those you put them in and then walk away. If you're going to do combat, the way I do it is throw the boys together with the female. And whichever boy you don't want to breed with the female that's in that cage, once the combat starts, hook that male that you don't want and pull him out, and then that's it. You're done. Combat's over. It doesn't
right.
need to be like a half-hour-long session of, you know, fighting back and forth. It can really take like 5 minutes.
Right. Yeah, because, you know, they're not the most intelligent creatures in the world as much as we love them. But
yep.
I think if you pull that male out, obviously the other male thinks he won because the other male is gone. And I think that the combat thing is just a way to, if you're not seeing anything with your male and you're kind of like, what the heck is going on, it's kind of an easy way to just kind of stimulate your male. There, like you said, your trick with the spray bottle with the sheds in it, that's ingenious. That's a good way to kind of avoid, any kind of, injuries that your snakes would ensue during a combat. It can get, it can, depending on the subspecies you're working with, it can get pretty violent.
It can,
but
for us, there can be some injuries.
Carpet pythons are pretty tough. I think there was a post up on Morelia Python Radio Facebook page maybe a week ago from our buddy Nathan down in Australia, and he was showing the battle scar from what could be a combat. It could also be from maybe some type of monitor, but regardless. It looked pretty horrendous.
and
it looked like it was doing okay. Okay, so that would be the whole thing with combat. I guess it's pretty interesting to watch, and when you see it, there's no doubt that what you're seeing is combat.
If your carpet python, if your two animals are trying to climb up the glass on top of each other, that's combat. Now, it's not going to be like they square off and they open mouth are fighting at each other, which if you were doing this with white lips, it is exactly the opposite. But if your snakes are trying, one's trying to get on top of the other, and they're both squirming and they're both climbing straight up almost, that's combat. Now, others do combat a little harsher than, it varies from male to male. Like this year I threw, I thought I had two females, and I threw my zebra jag in there. And they all, it turned out that one of the animals that was in there was actually a boy. So I had just thrown a proven breeding zebra jag boy in with a female jungle and a male jungle. So, of course, he and the other male jungle start combating. Now, I didn't really know what the combat was, because if any of us have ever seen a jag when it gets excited, it doesn't do combat very well. Let's put it that way. He starts corkscrewing, and he was losing pretty much. So I thought it might be combat, but I thought it might be that the zebra jag just got too excited. So I pull the other one out, and throw it into another cage with my other proven breeding male jungle. Now, when they started combating, it was no doubt. They threw the water bowl. They slammed each other against the wall, the door, the side. It was, that was, you know, the other extreme of combat. So either it's kind of not too frisky, just a lot of kind of trying to get on top of each other, or it's throwing each other into sides and things like that. So usually with the bigger boys is when you see the more aggressive combat.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I just looked and see if I could find a picture of male combating, but I'm going to throw up. There's a video over on the Facebook group page. It says male python breeding. It says snakes mating, but I believe that this is combat. So look at. It's just a video. Again, I'm just posting it up. I guess maybe I should watch it for a second to see if it is actually what they say it is. But, yep, that's combat.
Yes, yes it is.
Yeah, so there you go. Okay, check that out, male combat, there you go. There's also, maybe I'll throw up some pictures there. I know Will Bird is, he's a guy that is... big into combating the snakes, so you could check that out.
Maybe we'll take a video of combating over here.
Yeah.
I'll throw the jungle males in together and we can watch them square off. If they start breeding, though, clearly I have no idea what I'm talking about, and everyone should stop listening to me.
Okay, so next, when it comes to pythons, obviously ball pythons are, the star of the show type of thing, where most people are talking about breeding ball pythons. And with ball pythons, you can take one male and you can probably breed up to 8 females if you do it right, especially if you have an ultrasound. So that's where, having the right male would come in to where you could spread those genes out over multiple females and kind of, why it would make males more valuable. I personally, with carpet pythons, would not go more than 2. I think if you do more than 2, you're probably spreading your male too thin. I don't really have any basis to base that off of other than what I've heard or... what my experience are, but
I try to go 2 max.
That's what I was saying. Everybody's gonna watch. I'm sorry, this YouTube video that says that it's snakes are mating, but yeah, they're combating.
Yeah, those are facts. Fighting.
Yeah. So anyway, I would go 2. Is that kind of where you go? I'm sorry, 2.
I would go 2. I would go 2, but I have heard of 3. I know Jason Balin stretched his zebra out pretty far last year. I don't know if it was 3 or 4, but that boy apparently would have bred a piece of rope. So sometimes you get that boy, and sometimes you're lucky. Other times you get a boy that, doesn't want to breed at all. A friend of mine spent a crap ton of money on the first ever, albino boa constrictor that, he had. And he had all these females, and if he bred this albino boa to his animals, he was going to get, moon glows and be, one of the first people to get them. This boa constrictor would not breed a damn thing.
Wow.
A damn thing. For 4 years, wouldn't breed any female you put in with it.
Wow.
Yeah. So sometimes you just get that.
My caramel jag male. Oh, my God. I'm telling you what.
Hey, I get a caramel jag male. Bring it over here.
Yeah. He doesn't want to breed, man. He just –
Maybe he's content. Maybe he's not ready to give up his swinging bachelor lifestyle.
Yeah. He's not calling. So, as far as you're putting the male – what I found is that most people won't want aggressive males.
I love aggressive boys.
I got to give a shout out to my good friend Mr. Paul Harris from UK Pythons, and again Nick Mutton of Inland Reptiles, because you know one of the things that Nick always told me is that you want an aggressive male, and
yes.
Paul has always delivered the goods when it comes to aggressive.
I get jerk animals.
But I tell you what, man, they are solid breeders. They want to do it. There's no messing around. There's no sissiness about it. They just they go to town, and it is what it is. So I would highly recommend that you want males that, you know, they want to eat. They want to get it done because they're going to be aggressive about breeding as well. So it's definitely something that you, I would recommend.
You do. And you know what? It's also good because if you have a larger female, the more aggressive male is definitely going to be like a, you know, he's not going to back out. He's not going to back down. He's going to kind of come forward with it. So you don't really need to worry about that too much. So,
right.
Yeah.
So, okay. So there we go with that. As far as, you know, what do you think about as far as, well, let's do this. If you're breeding a male to multiple females, what are you doing? Are you doing it on any kind of rotation to where you're putting it 2 days in, 2 days out, this, you know, giving it a rest? How does that work with you?
I do have a rotation. Like right now, my caramel jag is jumped between two females, and then, of course, my gold white lip is jumped between two girls. What I have is I'm kind of hedging my bets a little, which is like cheating, because the caramel jag is in with my caramel female most of the time. And that's the one I really want him to breed. If he doesn't breed the other one, I'll be bummed, but I really want this one. So I kind of almost have it on like a staggered level. So I'm kind of cheating. So it's not really like, but normally what I'll do is they'll have a week in, a day or two in their own cage, and then a week in with the other female. So that's what I like to do. And that's just had me success in the past. But I could understand the 2 days in, 2 days out. So. Still there? Eric?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm there. I'm sorry. You got nervous. I kind of do the same thing. When I've done two males, I put the male in there for a couple days. I pull him out. I let him rest. I put him back in the other female's cage. If I notice that one female, I'm just paying attention to the females. If I don't see any more locks or they're sitting at other ends of the cage, you know, I'll separate them out. If I notice that they're cuddling together, then I might leave them in a little longer. So, again, I don't really follow.
Well, I mean, like you're saying, like you pay attention to your females. One of them starts showing signs of being gravid. The male maybe doesn't have to go in there anymore. So you focus on the other one. So that I like because then you get kind of like a staggered clutch. One will arrive earlier than the other, but they're both from the same father.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, there you go. I just posted up another video of some carpet pythons, but I got to get it over to the Facebook page. So,
I'll do basically, that pretend you're not there. Talks amongst myself.
No. I can do this as I talk. But do you do anything as far as any type of like spraying mist in to stimulate a rainy season or anything like that?
No, but I do with the white lips.
Okay.
I just flooded the black faces cage. We have two pairs of black faces. The one is settled in very nicely, and they're very cuddly and they're very nice. The other pair have tried to kill each other on two different occasions. So we're trying to make that pair get along. So we're doing some things like playing with the temps. We cooled them down a little bit lower. We raised them back up a little bit higher. And then now we just flooded the cage. And they both it's all quiet on the Western Front. So I'll see if that's what happens. But I've heard of other snakes needing monsoon seasons to breed and go through. I know Chris used to flood his cobra's cages all the time.
Right. Okay.
For breeding season.
Yeah, he was saying the one time he would just dump the water bowls in and then call it a day, right?
Yeah, he would flood the cobra's cages, and you know what? That's when they would have interest in each other. They would be ignoring each other completely. Second their cage is flooded and the humidity goes crazy, they start breeding. So.
Right.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm hoping that's what happens with these monsters. We'll see.
Yeah. Okay, so what are you seeing as what are you looking for in your females during this time when they're developing follicles? Do you see
if
it?
If they sit funny, you know.
Okay.
You breed a female for a certain number of years. You know every little twitch, every little thing. My female Lyra, your Hycon's mother.
Okay.
She acted like a chondro. She had a big old freaking perch in her cage. She would never come down off that perch. She ate off that perch. She crapped off that perch. She drank off that perch. She did everything on that damn perch. Want to know when I was do you want to know when I thought it was time to stop putting the mail in?
Yeah, when?
She was coiled on the ground. For the first time in about a year and a half, I saw her on the damn ground. And that's when I'm like, boy, I didn't need to go in anymore. She's done something different. So something must be going on here. And then,
right.
Of course, you know, with Aurora, she always used to sit just a little cockeyed, a little bit to the right when she had stuff brewing in there, whether you want to call them eggs, follicles, whatever. The second that stuff started going, sometimes your girls can't get their equilibrium right. Right now, Venus is looking massive, and so is my brettle female Raven. I'm looking right at her right now. They just seem thick, and you've got to think about it is that they haven't eaten in a very long time. Why does it look all of a sudden like each one of my girls is packing down a rat? So
right.
That's kind of what you're looking for, is you're looking for the swell. But the problem is that this is how you've seen them for most of the year, you know, fat and happy. So sometimes, like, I always think that my mind just plays tricks on me because this is how she's supposed to look. My male looks like shit, but she's the way she's supposed to look. And then after she lays the eggs, you realize, oh, holy crap. So
right.
Yeah. So right now you're just looking for any little kind of a subtle change in their behavior, in what they're doing. Sitting funny, favoring the heat, not putting up with the boy at all. Things like that.
Right. I kind of, like, the first time I did it, the first time, this was going back with my IJs, I kind of thought that I was seeing ovulation, then I wasn't sure, and I was kind of going back and forth. I wasn't, you know, but I think once you do it and you listen to people talk about it and you're seeing exactly what you're saying, you're paying attention, you know, no, it was. It was true. This was,
say it.
That picture was ovulation.
The serpent, right?
Josh is trying to say that this picture was an ovulation, but, you know, clearly eggs followed. But anyway, you know, it's something that once I think you've experienced that you'll be able to really get a feel for, and after you've heard people talk about it, if you're paying attention, you'll see it and you'll be able to tell. Now, sometimes you don't really see ovulation. Sometimes you'll miss it.
I never do. Yeah, I never seem to. Or I guess I just second-guess myself too much. But I always seem to never find it. So.
One of the things that I learned from last season as opposed to this season, because I remember you know, pulling the females out, and are they gravid, are they not gravid? I can't really tell. They feel tight, they don't feel tight. And I remember you were there, you're saying, yeah, this one feels it, this one doesn't, da-da-da-da-da. So I would say that my thought was is that I was really feeling the females all through the process. So, you know, once a week, taking the females out, I'm trying to get a feel for it, because I think if you want to learn how to do it, that it's important that you're paying attention and you're hands-on, because, you know, even though I think that, you know, ultrasounds are great and all, I think that ultrasounds may make you lazy, I guess, to a certain extent, if you haven't already experienced it, so that you know what you're looking for. I think that you should go through it, you know, without the ultrasound for a few times, and then once you have the ultrasound, it's only going to make you that much better at what you're, because you're looking for it as just looking at the female, you know what I mean?
Right.
You get a feel for it. So I guess in a way, I don't mean to say that people that use ultrasounds are lazy. I'm just saying that I think it would be better if you, you know, had a feel for what's going on. So that's what I'm doing this season. I'm really feeling, and I'm hoping that as I go through the process, I'll be able to feel tighter and tighter. I can't feel follicles worth a shit. I haven't been able to do that at all.
I can, but it the only time I can feel follicles, let's just put this way, I can't feel follicles, I can feel eggs. Which,
yeah.
By the time it's at that point, you should feel a dumbass. But I'm the same way. I'm just like, is this that? I've had females run through my hands. My first couple breedings, I was pulling the girls out so many times. I think a friend of mine told me to leave them the hell alone, that they'll never breed. So, yeah,
right.
It's just one of those things where, you know, you might miss it. You might miss the follicles. You might miss the ovulation. But you know what? As long as the boy is in there when he's supposed to be, they'll breed, and then she'll use it when she's supposed to use it.
Right. I guess with the real quick, we'll hit on palpating a female. You know, one of the ways that they say to do it is that if you grab your female, you kind of let her crawl through your hands, and you're feeling on the underneath, like on the belly scales, and
mm-hmm.
you're supposed to feel like these little bumps.
Yes.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think a carpet python that's the females are, the size that you want is maybe, I think it might be 25 millimeters. I have to look that up to verify that, but I'm pretty sure that's the size that you're looking for. But you're not going to be able to tell that from, you know, you're not going to be able to tell that in your hand that this is 25 millimeters.
You're not. The best way to feel it is just, I like to let them run through my hand and then just kind of lift your middle finger a little bit as they're going through your hand. And you'll feel the bumps come, like, over your finger. And, you know, you got to think about it this way. If they're not filled with feces or anything like that, and it's going to be very round. It's going to be, like, one right after the other, after the other, after the other, after the other.
Right.
And then also, the best thing I like to do is look on their sides, and if you start seeing scale separation, you're on the money. You're in it.
Right.
You know, you got to think about it this way. Their scales, they're going to spread so far apart that you're going to see the lighter edge of their scales around it. And you may even actually see skin in between the scales just because.
Right. Actually, let's back up for a second. If you're new to this and you're not sure what a follicle is, but a follicle is basically, it's essentially an egg that's in the development process. So it's, mm-hmm. It's an egg that's at the beginning of the development process, and if she's going to ovulate, those follicles go down into the oviduct, right? And
right.
That's when they would become fertilized, and that's when they would become an egg.
So if you if she ovulates, you're pretty much you're gonna have eggs. Hopefully, you don't have any kind of egg binding or anything like that. But pretty much, if you get past that process, you're pretty much locked in. So, you know, I think it's 20 millimeters. 25 is where it's when they're gonna ovulate. 25. Yep, that's what I thought.
Yep.
So palpating for the follicles, I guess a way to do it, a trick, you could grab a towel, a paper towel or something, a towel, a thin towel, kind of grab the female, hold her in your hand, let her crawl through it. And like I said, you might be able to feel them a little better when you have that towel rubbing against her. You might be able to see that. What about sheds? Are you seeing sheds during any of this time? Have you ever seen, you know, I know there's the pre-lay shed, but do you see the shed before ovulation?
Yeah, ov shed, the quote-unquote ov shed. Sometimes some have it, some don't, in my opinion. I've seen females that have ovulation sheds. I've seen females that will actually have eggs without even having the pre-lay shed. So, it's, shedding can be your best friend or your worst enemy. So, yeah.
What are you doing temp-wise once she's ovulated? Are you changing
once she's
anything?
Ovulated?
Yeah.
No, I keep on the normal thing of warming them up slowly. You know, she's ovulating and they're breeding and, you know, she's not full on grab it until we're right out there. So I know some people that will like stop everything and try to warm them all the way back up to the normal setting, but I just don't. I stick to it.
Okay. All right. So at this point, I would say the same. At this point, I'm going up and I'm offering the female that hotter spot if she wants to go and lay there or if she doesn't. But just like I said earlier, like when you are looking at the female and you're trying to get observations of what's going on, one of the things that, another thing that I would notice is that it seems like, I don't know if this is true with you, but it seems like to me when my females, they all ovulated pretty much at the same time. I don't know if that's, you know, once you get into breeding more and more, if you see that, I'm sure that maybe certain groups do or whatever, but I think once your room is in tune with stuff, you're going to start to see that maybe they'll go at the same time. But a sure sign, if now they're all of a sudden on the hot side of the cage, that would tell me that, you know, it's a sure sign that they may have ovulated and things are going good. I guess this is where you would observe the female laying basking belly up.
This would be right when you catch them with their basking belly up, and if they're basking belly up, you're good, and it does not take that long after they start to bask belly up for you to start getting towards the eggs. So
okay, so before the female is going to lay, she has what they call a pre-lay shed. So basically, mm-hmm. you're looking at a few weeks after ovulation, she will go opaque, and then she'll shed. Once she sheds, you're looking at about, what, 3 weeks from getting eggs?
Yes. 3 to 4, yeah.
So you're going to look at the female, and you're going to see the posterior third of her body is going to be, you know, this is where you're going to start to see the scale spread separation, and she's going to look thick. She's going to feel thick, nice and tight, and that's kind of where you know that she's pretty much ready to lay eggs. I know at this point you're going to be able to, depending on the size of your female, I would imagine you're going to have a hard time with, what's her name, feeling eggs inside
Sophie.
Her, right? Yeah, Sophie?
Sophie's just a giant mass from about midway all the way down the tail when she lays.
But in your smaller female, you're going to be able to, like, feel the eggs inside.
The eggs. Yeah. Maybe even see them, depending on how she's sitting.
Correct. You know, at this point, you know, you should be checking for eggs, you know, mark it on your calendar and you're pretty much going to see it, I would imagine, right on to the day. So next we're going to go into, you know, your Nest Box. When are you putting in, do you use a Nest? Let's start there. Do you use a Nest Box?
No, I do not.
No, okay.
I've tried to, but my girls always seem to just, you know, not use it. What I'll do, though, is they always have a hide box that they can fit into, and I'll usually just, because of the mulch, what they'll do is they'll usually do circles and make themselves a nice big divot in the mulch, and I'll just put a large hide box over the divot that they've made, and then there you go. They have a safe place that they feel they want to lay in, and they've pretty much picked the area that they want to put the eggs already.
Okay. So if so, you don't use an egg. I use an egg box. I guess if I was going to get into maternal incubation as we get farther down the list here, but I used to use ripped up newspaper or like unprinted newspaper as a substrate, but I had a problem with mold on a couple of the eggs. So last year I used sphagnum moss. It doesn't mold, and that's what I would use pretty much for my egg box. Basically what I do for, not egg box, I'm sorry, nest box. So basically what I do is I kind of get, I like a dark box. I like something that you can't see in. I know a lot of people want to see what's going on, but I kind of let the female do what she's doing. And I cut a hole in the top. I put the sphagnum moss inside, and that's pretty much it. I let her do her thing. And
makes sense.
What I've noticed, just an observation, and I've heard this from Jason Balin, and I think even Zach had this experience, is that if you put – I put the egg box in the middle of the cage, and the female pushed it over to the warmer side of the cage. I kind of pushed it back because I was nervous. I don't know, was this pushed there on purpose, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
But when I started seeing her continually push it to that side of the cage, I left it there, and then she went inside. So
that's where she wanted it, and you kept moving it, damn it. Yeah.
Correct. I think they know. Maybe, you know, if you put the egg box where you see she's lying, then maybe she'll go inside the egg box, or nest box. I keep calling it egg box.
Right.
I guess, you know, trains of thought, you don't – I know people that maternally incubate and they don't use a nest box. So I guess really it's a preference. I just think that – I think it makes the female feel secure. I think you can – she can maybe keep the temperature – where she wants it a little easier. That was my thought. I don't know if that's true or not true, but I would think she would be able to manipulate the temperatures easier, and it wouldn't take as much of a toll on her
within a box.
So
yeah. That
would be my thought. Okay, so there's that. You pre-lay shed. So now we got laying of eggs. What's your experience with that?
I've seen most of my females begin or finish laying. I've only ever been caught twice where I come walking down and she's completely done. If you ever have planned a weekend getaway or a day trip, that is when whatever female you've been waiting to lay is going to lay. Why? Because that's how that happens.
Yeah.
So normally what I'll do is, you know, most of the time they'll do what they're supposed to do. They'll stick their coils around and put their head at the bottom of the coils and lay the eggs directly on top of their heads so that they know where the eggs are. If you are going to do artificial incubation and you can get there while she's laying, it's
right.
A good idea to start pulling eggs almost immediately. Make sure some remain on her head. That kind of gives her a sense of that my eggs are right here, everything is fine.
Right.
And the ones you want to check, don't ever, ever, ever throw out an egg because you think it looks bad. There's always the point of no return, and you want to make sure that the egg is far beyond that before you chuck it. I've had some of the ugliest eggs hatch. I know Buddy posted a picture of an egg that had a little bit of a weak point in the egg.
Right.
And he said you could even see the red neonate forming inside.
Right. Which is pretty cool.
Echo's egg was almost half weak shell. I saw that snake develop from like day one all the way up to hatching. Like
okay.
You could see clearly inside that thing. It was awesome. But, you know, don't ever throw it out unless it's slimy, green, and smelly. So.
Yeah, I usually go by the smell. If it smells,
yep.
I that's it. It's done.
But. Now, normally what people will do is they'll candle immediately, and then everybody gets bummed out because they don't see veins. It takes a little bit for the veins to develop. So don't candle immediately expecting to see nothing but, you know, bright red and veins everywhere. Give it some time, give it a few days, then candle your eggs, and then you'll see veins. And just because an egg is bright yellow when you candle it doesn't mean it isn't going to be good in a few days. So don't worry.
Right. The thing that I would say, what's your experience with, you know, one of the things when I was getting into python breeding was getting the eggs away from a female. What's your thoughts on that? You want to try to, the trick is you want to keep the eggs safe and you want to keep the female safe as well.
I will let my females chew on my arm if it means that the eggs are okay. But normally if you get them right after eggs, they're so tired. I mean, they just did a lot, and they'll go without a fight unwinding from the eggs. They'll make a lot of noise, but there won't be any teeth. And then you can easily transfer them into a holding tub and then take care of the eggs. What I didn't know my first time breeding is that you need to wash everything. If you're going to take the eggs, you need to wash the entire cage, bleach everything, clean all the hide boxes, get the egg box out of there, and then you actually have to give mom a bath. What I normally do is take a rag that's been soaked up with joy and run it down her entire body, and then I'll take another rag that's just kind of wet with water and then wipe that down her entire body too, and then you can put her back in. Otherwise, she'll try to incubate non-existent eggs. She'll curl up around the first thing that smells like those eggs and start twitching. So.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen that.
You know, what's funny is that Aurora, the second clutch I had from her, after the babies were hatching, I took the eggshells out and I put them down on top of Aurora's cage. It just happened to be the cage that was over there. And I just put them down and I kept working, doing all this stuff, tending the babies. I turned around and Aurora had balled up all the newspaper in her cage and was starting to incubate it.
Right.
Yeah.
How about that?
So I'm like, holy, I'm like, you've not seen these eggs for two freaking months and you're trying to incubate them. It's like, and I had to wash her entire cage again, wash her down and put her back in. She clicked right back over. She was perfectly fine. She wasn't trying to like look for eggs or anything, but it was like, even after that long of a time, she still tried to take care of them.
Okay. How about that?
Yeah.
Freaky. Yeah, I think one of the things that led me to even really try maternal incubation was the whole fact that I just kind of didn't want to take the eggs away from the female. And
you didn't
want
to
so
be
I'm
the big bad wolf that takes the babies away from their mother. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just kind of let them in there, and you know, that's it. So. I guess I'll hit on maternal incubation first, and then you can hit on artificial incubation.
Sure.
What to do? Maternal incubation. Okay, so your female laid eggs. If she pretty much laid eggs. She laid the eggs there for a reason. She feels that there are adequate temperatures inside the cage and where she laid them. You know, that's pretty much... At least for me, that's how I look at it. She thinks that the situation, the environment is adequate to hatch python eggs. I don't change anything that I normally do for my cage temperatures. I let her figure out what she wants to do as far as temperatures. I ripped up unprinted newspaper. I noticed an issue with mold in the one clutch, and I think that had to do with I crumpled up too much, like it was too thick in one spot. And some of the interesting things that I've seen with maternal incubation is the female actually kind of scoops the eggs up, and she'll move them over to one
right.
side of the tub or to the other side of the tub. I've seen to where she actually will put her head down inside the coils, and she'll kind of raise the temperature inside the coils, not the temperature, the humidity. If the eggs are, you know, she wants to add, like she thinks they're getting too dry. What else? It's pretty straight ahead. It's pretty simple. The only thing that I would say is that you definitely have to have a backup plan. That's number one thing.
That's for damn sure.
That's the most important thing that I learned the first year that I did it. Because there are times when the female will leave the eggs for no reason at all. Obviously she thinks there's a reason. Maybe the temperatures inside are not adequate and she's out, you know. I don't know, but there is times when females will leave the egg. It has been said that JAGs are not the best maternal incubators. They kind of just... Poor JAGs, they don't really...
They can't do anything right. They can't combat right. They can't really incubate right.
But that's not to say that JAGs have not done it. But, you know, I don't know if carpet pythons are just really good at maternal incubation or carpet python breeders are just really good at letting their females maternally incubate their eggs. I've heard people maternally incubate... ball python eggs, chondro eggs. I've never heard scrub eggs.
We were going to do if we got eggs from ours, we were going to let them do maternal just because we didn't want to have to be the ones to go in there and separate a 10-foot pissed off mother from her babies. So
that was
the rule of like, you know, if they breed, she's going to do it all the way just because I don't want to do it. So.
It's definitely a cool process to watch. It's definitely something that, you know, I mean, you've kind of, if you're into carpet pythons, it's definitely something that I would recommend, you try and at least once just to get a feel for what it is. That's the one thing. The other thing is that I would definitely check the female because in my last year's breeding, if I would have let my female Carmel go the distance with just maternally incubating her eggs, she probably would have died because she had three eggs inside of her still. Not really sure why that happened. My thought is right. that she, like Owen said earlier, a little bit on the small side. So that also taught me a lesson. You know, I'm all about telling people my mistakes, and by all means, I'm not a perfect, breeder by any stretch of the means, but I think you learn from mistakes. I think it's important to share your mistakes. You have some people that, you know, they don't really they don't want it to be knowledge that people, you know that they made mistakes,
right.
But I think it's important. So anyway,
right.
That's pretty much maternal incubation. I know that people want to hear more details about it, but it's just pretty straight ahead. I mean, you just leave the snake do her thing, and she'll do it. You would think it would be much more stressful, but I think once you do it and you're past maybe like the first 2 weeks, it just becomes easy, you know. It just becomes pretty simple. You will see the female leave the egg sometimes, and then she'll come back. I saw that a couple times. I got really nervous about it, but she went back. I had one female that she would always take her head out of the nest box. She would raise it up to the. I had actually. I was using bulbs for heat, and she would just put her head at the bulb, and then she would, go back.
Bring it back in to warm everybody.
Yeah, I don't know what that was about. I guess just to raise the temperature or whatever, but
that's
so
cool.
Be it. Yeah, that was a cool thing that I saw. But probably the best thing of maternal incubation, I think, is when you see her, she loosens up her coils, and there's a baby snake's head sitting out of the egg. That was just really, really cool. I really dug it. But that's pretty much it. I don't know. What
cool.
about artificial?
Artificial is a little bit more, you got to do a little bit more with that. Definitely once you get the eggs away from mom, you want to set them up in your egg box. Now, there are two methods. There's either suspension, which is you get the eggs off the substrate, and normally the way I do it is I have them on a plastic cup or a plastic grid above my substrate. Now, there's a couple things you use as substrate. You can either use vermiculite. I use perlite, which is the white things that are in potting soil. Some people even use just straight water or just normal dirt. So you can use all those. You want to get your substrate to the consistency of wet sand. So now there's some people that went like it's supposed to be one-to-one ratio, one part water, one part substrate. And for your first year, you are going to mix it like a son of a bitch. You're going to, one part water, one, oh, God, it's too much water, and then you scrap everything and retry. By your third year, you throw everything together, you swirl it around, you grab a clump of it, make sure it clumps together, and you're going to go. So it really gets a whole lot easier. You want to put the eggs in. If you can separate the eggs, if they're not fused together, that is ideal. Just in case one goes bad, you can get it out of there. But you don't have to. I've put eggs in that have been joined all over the place, and they hatched out fine. So no need to worry about that. Like I said, you either put them on top of a grid or a grate on top of the substrate, or you can even put them partially buried or in the substrate. So that's another option for you. What I like to do is I usually have my incubator set for 88 degrees because it has a swing where it'll hit 88 degrees and then shut off. And then when it goes down to 87, it'll turn back on again. So it keeps it at that normal 87.8 degree temperature inside the incubator. They'll normally just cook right in there for 2 months. I don't let the babies hang out in the egg box once they hatch. I've heard too many stories of babies going underneath the grid into the substrate and drowning or doing something stupid. So once they hatch, they're out. So that's something else you kind of have to be concerned about.
Right.
Yeah. But the incubator that I have, you always want to – there are two things you never want to skimp on, your animals and then your incubator. So – the incubator I have is run by a Ranco thermostat system. Like I said, I have it set for 88. And then my incubator is actually an old Pepsi refrigerator. I'm sorry, Coca-Cola, because it has a little Coca-Cola handle. Anyway, it's a Coca-Cola refrigerator. Now, that works great. I have a piece of FlexWall that runs down the bottom, and it's all plugged in. I also have other computer systems in it that tell me the exact temperature of the incubator in there at all times. Now, I gutted the incubator, the fridge. I went through it. I ripped out the freezing elements of it, the cooling elements of it, as well as the motor, all that stuff. Drained it completely of all Freon and oil, but I kept the electrical systems intact. So when the fridge is on, or when the incubator turns on, the light turns on, and the fans that would run the cooling system also turn on, so you get a nice air exchange. It's important to get some air exchange, but not to have air constantly blowing on your eggs, because that's never going to be good. And nor do you want stagnant air. So it's just my way of fixing that. I've heard a lot of people take computer fans from computers and plug them into their incubators. That works too. My first original incubator was actually a chicken egg incubator, one of those expensive ones, not the styrofoam one, but the other one. That worked out great for me too. So there's multiple ways to skin this cat. So, you know, incubators can be whatever, what have you. So,
sure.
That's what I have there. And I've done well with the artificial. My joke is always that I'll have to do maternal just because I have the sheer number of pairings. But I haven't yet hit that point where the incubator is full, so...
There you go. Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. I can see why, you know, and again, this is a thing, you do what you feel comfortable with.
Right.
You know, if you feel comfortable doing an artificial because you like to micromanage everything and, you know, you want to make sure that everything is dialed in the way you want it, then, you know, so be it. Some people believe that the snake knows best and, you know, don't want to worry about it. So, you know,
I completely agree with you that there's nothing like seeing the babies come out of the egg.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's like my favorite part.
Yeah, I just posted up a pic over on the Facebook page, just showing you that was, you know, here's what I can tell you is that this was that picture that I posted up was my first clutch, and that mm-hmm. was the first time that I've seen a baby carpet coming out of an egg. It was kind of like I saw the entire life cycle and. You know, I was hooked. I was hooked from that moment on. And that's why maternal incubation is so cool to me, is because that was my first breeding season. And to see that picture right there that, you know, I went into my snake room and there she was. She opened up her coils. And as you can see, that's the shredded, unprinted newspaper.
Is that MI success?
Yeah, you're going to put MI fail?
I don't have that picture.
Damn. Would have been good.
Damn it. Sorry. opportunity missed.
Yeah, I will say real quick with the, you know, you've heard me talk about this numerous times. You know, some eggs will fall out of the coils. Mm-hmm. The mom will, you know, if she doesn't have a good wrap around it, then you may want to pull the eggs. You definitely, you know, want to do it. What I do at this point, after I saw the egg, the one snake pipped out, I pulled the eggs from the mom. That's when I pulled the eggs from the mom. Well, as soon as I saw that, because I don't want them getting crushed or anything like that. So I guess, you know, me personally, I pulled the eggs, I put them in a tub, I put them in the rack, and that's kind of what I did, and just kind of watched them pipped out one at a time. When the first clutch, as soon as I saw, I let them naturally pip out of the egg on their own.
Right.
The second clutch that I did that year, as soon as I saw the one head pop out, I cut the rest of the eggs.
I do cut. I mean, that's another preference that you have to have. Normally, if I see one baby pip, and I'll cut the rest. Because there have been numerous times where I've had babies that would I had a baby this year, I had a caramel come completely out of the egg, go back in the egg, and then drown. So, Yeah, and that a kick in the pants, but it happens. They're not the brightest of creatures. So, and you know, I've had babies that were really tiny that, you know, were only able to get out of the egg because I sliced it. So, and now, and those babies, you know, they may not be the first ones to feed, but eventually they do, and then they end up growing, and there's really no issue in the first place.
Right.
So.
So, yeah, I kind of, so you have the eggs, the snakes are cut. They'll sit in the eggs for, what would you say, how many days?
A few days. It's perfectly normal if it's, like, going on almost, like, say they started pipping on Monday, and say there's still a few of them sitting in there on, like, Sunday. That's perfectly normal. So, like, almost a week.
Okay. And then you'll see them all coming out.
After a week, I start making the hole. Yeah, after a week, I start making a hole a little bit bigger. Because then they start getting the freaking idea to get the hell out of the egg. So.
Right. You know, there's a whole lot of things that can happen once the baby is coming out, you know, but I guess what we'll talk about now is what you do to set them up. Basically what I do is I leave them all in the box until they're all out. Once they're all out, I sex them, I separate them, I put males in one tub, females in another tub. And I do that by popping them. I learned that from you, Owen, that basically, you know, I was scared to death to pop the snakes. I thought I would break them, you know, actually you talk about it, the muscle control and all that. Well, go ahead.
Well, the idea is that once they hatch, they can't really control the muscle. So I always, normally when, once they hatch, I told you, I never let them hang out in the bin. So once they're out of the egg, I have been set up as boy and girl, and they have wet paper towels. And so baby comes out, I pop it, and then I put it in the appropriate bin. The second they hatch, the muscle control is really not there, and it's really easy to pop them. You don't need to put that much force into it, and you don't have to worry about hurting them. The older they get, the harder it gets to be to pop them. You can, I've popped a 6-foot carpet python for breeding purposes. He was at college, I did a artificial insemination project with my carpet pythons, and we actually collected from two of my carpet python males, collected their sperm, and were attempting to freeze it for artificial purposes. We never got so far, that far, but we did collect from my males. The way I did that is I actually popped them, and it took a while, and they were not pleased when I did it. So that's something else you have to deal with, is they're going to be pissed. So as babies, they might bite you, but who the frick cares? And you pop them for a little bit, everything, the boys will chew right out, and then you're good to go. Usually put the boys in the tubs, and then, again, I'll resex them when I give them their individual cages and cage numbers, which is a couple, about a week or two down the road. I usually separate them before their first shed. This way I know who shed and who hasn't. So.
Yeah, I basically do the same thing. And again, now, I pretty much.
I will say.
Yeah.
Don't ever attempt to pop a hatchling or a baby by yourself. Get someone who is experienced to show you and walk you through it. Because you could do a lot of damage to a baby if you do it too hard or you do it wrong. And it's not that hard, and it's really not that difficult, so it shouldn't be – there should be someone out there who's willing to show you.
Yes. You could check out our buddy Bill.
Yes.
Bill Stegall. He, from Phoenix Reptiles, he did a really good video on popping – baby carpets. See if I can find it real quick. But Owen, talk a little bit about how you're setting the babies up, what you're doing, and how you get the feeding trials going.
Normally, what I'll do to set the babies up is I have the shoebox racks for my babies, and I put them in on newspaper, and I usually give them a small little hors d'oeuvre cup filled with water, or a cut solo cup filled with water, maybe even a little stoneware if I can. I've melted holes in my tub so I can zip tie the solo cuffs to the side, because I'm finally listening to you. So, you know, it's only taken like, what, 3 years? But so that's one thing you can do. I used to put the small PVC tubing in there for them to perch on, and I still have it. I do it, but I don't like to start off doing it. Some babies, of course, like babies do sometimes like to perch, but then some just get rolling without having to perch, and, you know, you don't need to change that. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. I'll usually wait till they shed, and then I'll offer food. If you can get like three babies to eat out of an entire clutch in your first feeding trial, you're God. So usually takes about the second or third time they see the food is when they actually are like, oh, my God, and that's when they start eating. Everybody should start rolling if after about a month after their first shed, like everybody should be rolling and shedding and things like that. If you got some stragglers, that's when you can start changing some things up. The way I like to change things up is that's when you add the perching, because then maybe that gives them that little bit of security and they'll start eating. Or I have these small cube cages with big tree branches in it. I'll throw the baby in there. A little hatchling in a giant cage sitting on a tree branch. I've had them, I've had babies click over and start eating once I do that. Just being in that bigger cage with that big intricate branch, they lots of hiding spaces. They seem okay with it, and that's when they start eating.
Okay.
You can always offer different food items. A bunch of the scrubs and things here eat chicken and things like that. So a chicken foot every once in a while, or a wing. Sometimes we'll get a baby to eat. And then, of course, there's the all the other alternative methods that we've heard, from yogurt to tuna fish to, you know, sacrificing a horse on your snake room floor to get the, that one thing to eat. I mean, yeah, there's many different things.
So. Okay. Yeah, I guess with me, I don't really – I don't really worry about the feeding. I let them do their thing. I had that zebra jag that didn't eat for 6 months. So I don't know. I kind of let them do their thing and don't sweat it out. Just be patient with it. And I offer them food. One thing I would say is that you don't offer them food every day. You know, pick your day. You're going to feed on Monday. You take your food out. You offer them food. If you don't, you know, if it doesn't happen, then wait till the following Monday. Let them settle in. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I would say is I use little paper towel rolls, the actual cardboard tube. I use those for hides for baby carpets, and I found that once they have a hide, they do pretty good. I used to use smaller cups for my baby carpets as far as water bowls, but what I found is that if I use a 16-ounce deli cup, they'll actually perch on the deli cup, and it kind of eliminates me having to get a perch for them. And
that's a good idea.
It works out pretty well. And they will perch right on that deli cup, and I found that if they can perch, they usually feed pretty well. I don't know if there's a correlation between that, but that's been my experience. My experience is that's what I do. I just kind of put them in there. I wait them out. They shed. That's when I start trying to feed. What would you say is the proper time to put a baby carpet up for sale? Like, when do you know that you've established the baby carpet?
I normally wait till they've eaten about 10 times.
10 times. Okay.
Yeah. Of course, I say that, but if it hatches and it's hitting food like it's going out of style, I might sell it to somebody who I know is experienced. Like, you know, say you were on a wait list for a super caramel, and this one super caramel came out of egg and was like hitting food like crazy, I'd let you take it early. I'd let someone who I know is experienced with raising a hatchling or doing this, if they want it early, they can have it before the 10 feed mark, but normally by 10 feeds, you've hammered out all the kinks, because sometimes, you know, you get a baby that comes out of the egg, eats three times, and then decides it doesn't want to eat two times you offer, and then it comes back on. So sometimes you gotta wrestle with them a little bit. So.
Okay.
You know exactly where you are when you're done there.
Yeah.
I had a huge problem this year with the babies. The baby super caramels didn't want to leave the water. They kept climbing into their waters, and they did that so much that one of them actually started getting the blister disease.
Oh, really?
Just from never leaving its damn water. So, I had to start pulling water bowls away from super caramel babies as they were growing up. Now, of course, they're all fine, and, you know, everybody's blister-free and eating, and they all spend an appropriate amount of time in their water bowls. But, For the first couple of years, I didn't know what the hell was going on. So.
Wow. That's pretty.
The weird thing you learn, like a good tip for eggs, if you are doing incubation artificially and you get some mold, get a Q-tip and water down some Listerine.
There you go.
You can use that to wipe off the mold, and it does not hurt the egg.
Okay.
Also, your babies come out minty fresh.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
What about, I guess the last thing maybe we'll, two things is, what are you looking for in your holdbacks? And let's talk specifically, since you have the most experience with coastals, you're looking at your coastal carpets, what would you look for as what you consider your holdback?
See, that goes all the way back to why did you do the pairing? You did the pairing for a reason. That was to produce blank. And when you produce blank, you look for the best thing that you've made, and that's your holdback. If it's a boy, great. If it's a girl, fantastic. If you needed a boy and all you got are really good-looking girls, guess who just got a girl? So that's what you have to do. That's how you start seeing projects through. I did caramel with the tiger not last year. Was it last year? No.
Year
before. 2012. I did that 2012. I was dying for a caramel tiger boy. That's what I wanted, caramel tiger boy.
Right.
And I got a caramel tiger girl. So the idea was either you sell it and you try again to get a boy, or you take what you got and you roll.
Right.
So sometimes your holdbacks are kind of decided for you. Other times it's kind of not. Like right now, I was going to keep back a super caramel female from this year's clutch, because next year I'm kind of hoping to make super caramel jags, and I'll keep a boy back from that clutch. So right now I got three super caramel girls. They're all vying for who gets to say. And right now there's one clear winner because she's the one that's eaten the best out of the other two, and she's the one who's gotten bigger, and she's the one who's got the color. So, but of course, do I really want to let the other two go to find out that just because they were a little bit of late bloomers, that I let the better-looking one go.
Right.
So what I look for is the best of the project that you've done. So, I mean, if the main goal, like your goal this year is to make double-head snows.
Yep.
Now, you're going to make double-head snows, and they're all going to look a certain way. But there's going to be one that catches your eye for some reason or another, and that's the one you're going to go with. So you're going to have to trust your gut and think that that is something different, that is something special. I want that one.
Right.
And this is the best kind of snake shopping because there ain't nobody in front of you. You made it. You get to pick.
Yeah, that is the cool thing about that. You know, you get first pick, and you get to say whether or not you You dig the snake, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's I love it because people were like, people have said to me numerous times, well, I get first pick at the clutch, right? I'm like, sure. Oh, after me, you get first pick. I still get first pick. Why? It's mine. So, you know, it's been a few times where I've had people come over and be like, how about that one? I'm like, that one's mine. And so it's something cool. And it's, and you know, sometimes your plans change even as you're breeding. You know, maybe you wanted to hold back something from this clutch, but then before the clutch even hit the ground, your project changed or something happened, or, you know, you had to alter the plans. Maybe you'll keep a different one. Like, I was going to keep the first zebra jag I produced out of my breeding of my zebra boy to a jungle female in 2 years. I don't need to do that anymore. I have a zebra jag. And I'll keep the first, and, you know, and it's just the way it is. So.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. I mean, as far as, like, what I'm looking for in a holdback, I guess really it kind of depends on, like, what you're saying. One of the things, I guess, that I would recommend, and I know this isn't the easiest thing to do, but this is kind of why you should start out maybe with just a few pairings or such, is that if you breed, you know, with my IJs, I held on to them for quite a while because I wanted to see how they develop. So I guess my tip with that would be to kind of, you know, see what goes on, see how they develop, see how they color up. Maybe make notes to what you thought was a good holdback and what you thought it was going to happen. And I guess after time, you may start to see, you know, after doing it for years, you're going to start to see, you'll be able to pick out immediately what you're looking for in a holdback or, you know, what you're looking for and is going to color up for a nice carpet. Because unlike ball pythons, carpet pythons have the opposite. You know, ball pythons come out of the egg and they look their best and man, they look cool as shit. You know, everything looks good. They're bright. Their colors pop. Contrast is there. Carpets, they don't have that same luxury. They come out the ugly duckling of the world. They start out really, you know, dull, drab looking. IJs are red. They're solid red. And then, you know, they work in reverse. You know, they start to color up. The contrast comes in, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's kind of a crap shot. You know, it's not as bad as chondros, but you're up there with, they're so variable, and you don't really know what's going to happen and how they're gonna progress. So, you know,
good luck. My thing is don't be afraid to, don't ever think that you're holding back too many. I mean, you know, yes, there is such a thing as holding back too many. I think holding back an entire clutch is insane unless you hatch out like a all like purple carpet python. I mean, then you got to hold back the whole damn clutch. But you know, if you want to hold back three or four, do it, because they're going to grow and you're going to assess the situation, and then you can always sell the other ones later. That's fine. The second you put in an ad or anything was going to be my holdback, but I decided to let it go. People seem to jump all over that because now you've given it your seal of approval of that I would have kept this if I could. So don't worry about not being able to sell your holdbacks. That's something that should be way far out of your head. And the idea of breeding is, you know, you want to expand your projects. You want to make your projects better. You want to continue forward. The only way to continue forward is to give yourself that one leg up that you get by breeding it yourself. So keep the best-looking ones you got, and then eventually down the road, you're going to be producing things that come blow that one out of the water. Look at Jason Balin's Red Project, his Red Tigers.
Right.
They are nothing compared to the Red Tigers he made a couple of years ago.
Oh, heck.
Nothing. So, and that just comes to everything that came out of that egg that was bright freaking red that he thought was cool, he kept.
Right. Smart man.
Mm-hmm. Smart man, that Jason Balin. I'll see him Saturday.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, that'll pretty much lead. I think the only thing that I'm going to close with is, you know, you got the babies going back up, and I guess we can go in another episode. Maybe we'll talk about on the holiday show. We can briefly hit on maybe, you know, selling the babies, wholesaling, not the wholesale, whole culling, you know, babies and stuff like that. And we'll hit on some of those topics. But the one thing that I would say with maternal incubation that I forgot to hit on is carpet python females coming out of the breeding season they look like death.
they look terrible.
Yeah, they look horrible, which is why some people will do artificial incubation, because it gives that female a longer time to get back in shape for the following breeding season.
To bounce back.
If you're doing maternal incubation, I'm sure that you can breed females back-to-back. I know people do it. I personally would not. I want to make sure that my female is in tip-top shape, so I would probably wait a year between clutches. So that's kind of the only Some people would look as a drawback of doing maternal incubation.
You may have to wait.
Yeah. So you want to start getting that female going and feeding right away and getting the food back in her. And, the sooner the better to get her back in shape. Because they will.
They look terrible. And you know what? What's funny is that I will offer food the night after I take the eggs away. And almost all my girls will eat the day after.
Sure.
Like the day of. Like I take away the eggs and I offer food, they'll eat.
Yeah.
So it's don't worry about that. You know, they might take them a day or two, but those girls are hungry. So
I guess we'll wrap it up and like I said, we'll hit on some more stuff in another episode. And, you know, as we learn through this season, we'll be able to come back and talk about it a little more once we go through another season. So I hope that this helped some people with some of the thoughts of breeding carpets. Relatively in the pythons world, carpet pythons are pretty simple to breed. Maybe some of the more the spring breeders are maybe a little bit trickier, but overall carpet pythons are pretty straightforward. And they're worth it. They're definitely worth it. They're a cool snake, they give you a nice pile of eggs, say 15. Unless you're Owen, you might get 50.
52, sir. 52.
Yeah. It kind of depends. So,
yeah.
So yeah, well, that's. I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to hit on, Owen. Otherwise, we'll do our shout out.
I'm good, man.
Okay. We want to give Mr. Chris Behoff a shout out. Just like we are nominated for Radio of the Year. He is nominated for, I don't know what the exact saying is. Did you see this yet, Owen?
The
personality.
Asshole of the Year? Oh, personality of the Year. Okay.
Yeah. Well, we'll call it personality. Let's give Mr. Behoff some love. Go over to, I'll put the link over on the Facebook page. But wouldn't it be cool that the personality of the year is a carpet python person and the radio show of the year is a carpet python radio show? The year of the carpet, it just would be cool. Show some carpet pythons some love. So yeah,
yes.
Definitely go over there and check that out. All right. Next week we have Miss Nick Mutton is coming on, our good buddy, Mr. Nick Mutton, and he will be talking Brettles. AKA Centralians, Morelia Bretelli. He's going to go through it beginning to end. Got a lot of feedback that people wanted to hear about Brettles, and we're going to break it down. We're going to do some natural history. We're going to do breeding. We're going to do the hit on what the morphs are that are out there. Why did they separate, become their own species, et cetera, et cetera. I couldn't think of anybody better to talk about Brettles than Nick because he works with the most diverse group in the U.S., if available. And he has five bloodlines and cool stuff. It's pretty cool that tomorrow I will have the Afors bloodline in my house. So that's pretty
nice.
Exciting. Be sure to tune in next week for Mr. Nick Mutton. He's always a good guest and makes you always leave saying, wow, he knows a lot about pythons. So, mp.com, MoreliaPythons.com. That's who sponsors us. Go check out the forum. MoreliaPythonRadio.com. Go over there and see what's going on in the world of Morelia. If you have any questions, comments, you can contact us at info@MoreliaPythonRadio.com. Go over and sign up for the newsletter. You can do that right over on the page. That's going to be coming out soon, so stay tuned for that. I want to give a shout-out again to Chris Behoff for Carpet Python's classified page. If you're looking for a carpet python, like we said at the beginning of the whole thing, find yourself a good breeder, and I would look no further than the Carpet Python Breeder Registry, which can be found on www.morelia.trherp.com. That will give you a list of some of the top guys and girls in the U.S. For breeding carpet pythons, and you know, pretty much puts you in touch with them. So that's a cool thing. Corrales Radio, go over and check those guys out. They're doing a good job over there. They have some cool shows already in the archives. I've been listening to a few of them and going back and listening again because Corrales is a pretty cool species that I want to learn about, or I should say genus that I want to learn about. But you can check them out at corralesradio.weebly.com. We already talked about next week. For me personally, ebmorelia.com. If you have any questions or comments, want to get on the waiting list, go over at, you can email me at eric@ebmorelia.com. And don't forget to vote for us for Radio Show of the Year. That's all I got. Owen, take us out.
What we got is you can go through rogue-reptiles.com to find out all the latest stuff happening at Rogue. You can also find Rogue Reptiles at facebook.com. We will be at this Saturday's Hamburg Reptile Show in Hamburg, Pennsylvania. Stop on by. Chat some carpet pythons. Check us out. Also, Jason Balin, Mo from Mojo Reptiles will be there, and Howard from Reading Reptile Breeders will be there. So it's a carpet python kind of show. Come on out. With that, what we'll say is good night, and we hope to see you all next week for some more Morelia Python Radio. Good night.